Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a non-profit, non-partisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
I'm Lucy Billingsley, and it's my pleasure to get to introduce Isabel Coleman to you all today. Dr. Isabel Coleman is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and her area of focus, as you know, is women and gender issues. Her academic background is Princeton and then Oxford. I always dreamt about being able to say that about one of my children. It won't happen. I'm on to grandchildren's hopes in that regard. Oh, no, I've got a niece. Anyway, Isabel's work is a work of great study, of great depth and understanding to penetrate Islamic issues today, women's issues, many countries in the Middle East, and the changes that they're going through. She's written many articles on these topics, brought many great speakers to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, a couple of whom we've snagged to Dallas as well, and many more whom we'll snag in the future. And in her work, it's not just bringing the facts forth to us as the circumstances, but it is a great deal of intuition and insight. Isabel's work is not work just for her own edification, but her goal is to spread it deeply so that all of us, too, might have the same depth of insights, the same depth of understanding, and thus change our worldviews as a result of it. So I ask you to join me in listening to Isabel's trends and information today, with ears to say, how might we better understand? And then with that understanding, how can we change and what might we do to help build tomorrow to the world and the peace and the circumstances that we all so very deeply yearn for? So Isabel, we're counting on you for a great deal. Just come change our lives. Give us insight. Welcome to Dallas.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you for that nice introduction. And for all of your hospitality, I have spent the last 2 days in Dallas here. I was an Ullman Fellow at the Hockaday School, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with the school. And it was a terrific experience to come down and spend a day and a half at the school. I gave a talk at the upper school yesterday to 9th through 12th graders and the faculty, and then spent time yesterday afternoon and this morning in various classrooms, and just really impressive meeting with these young women and hearing what they're up to and seeing how they're learning. Boy, things have changed since I was in high school. That's all I can say. And Lucy had a wonderful dinner last night, and I thank you for your hospitality. The Middle East is burning, and I am here talking not about the fact that we're moving warships into the Gulf and that there are groups talking about bombing Iran and that we are adding troops to Iraq or any of the other issues that are so top of everybody's mind today. I am here to talk about something else, which you may think, how can that even begin to compare as an urgent issue? And that is the youth bulge in the Arab world. But it is a very urgent and important issue. And while our headlines and our day-to-day thoughts are dominated by the last car bombing, the fact that the Arab world, that a third of the Arab world is under the age of 15, 60% of the Arab world is under the age of 25, and that today unemployment in that part of the world is 15%, and if they don't create 80 million new jobs over the next 15 years, that will go up dramatically. They need 80 million new jobs just to keep unemployment at 15%. They need 100 million new jobs to try to lower that to anything reasonable. I mean, this is a huge challenge. During the economic boom years in the United States, we created jobs at an unprecedented rate. They need to double that to keep pace with 15% unemployment. People say to me, why are people rioting in the streets over a bunch of cartoons? And the answer to that is long and complicated, but a short answer is because they don't have a job. They have nothing else to do. And they are related. The fact that you have young people who have high expectations, no chance of meeting those expectations, and they live in very polarized, very fraught times, it leads to extremism. It leads to extreme behavior. And so the job situation, lack of jobs, the demographic situation in the Middle East is something that's urgent and that we should all be aware of and we should think about. Over the last, 10 years, reform in the Middle East has been a very big topic. And it was a huge debate among foreign policy experts. Do we focus on democracy or do we focus on economic reform? And the democratization adherents won out. Let's push for democracy. Let's push for democracy and economic reform will follow. And I think we have seen a failure in many respects on that front. And today, as Condi Rice travels through the Middle East, democracy isn't even on her agenda. She's not talking about democracy with Hosni Mubarak right now. She's not demanding greater reforms from King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia. We have limited our leverage and our influence in the Middle East region enormously by recent policies. But it doesn't mean that we can walk away from that part of the world by any means. We have to find other ways and other means of being effective and being influential in a constructive and positive way. And I think that we need to go back to that earlier debate and re-engage on the issues of economic reform because there truly is an urgent need for economic reform in that part of the world to begin employing and finding employment for this very young population that's going to move through the system over the next 40 years. So economic reform, clearly it's about liberalizing economies, it's about privatization, it's about free trade agreements. Jordan has a free trade agreement with the United States. It involves many different factors. But it also involves reform of the educational systems in that part of the world. And unfortunately, the educational system is broken across the region and across the whole educational spectrum. So many of you are aware that the Middle East has high illiteracy rates. It also has, relative to its income level and to its development, it has lower enrollment rates than it should. And it's hard to generalize about the region as a whole. There are three countries that comprise the majority of the illiteracy problem in the Middle East: Morocco, Egypt, and Yemen. Three relatively large countries in terms of population. And these countries have an enormous need still to invest in the most basic levels of education, getting kids in school. But many of the other countries have made huge strides, and Egypt, Morocco, and Yemen have all also made big strides in getting kids in school. They just still have a long way to go. But other countries have already gotten, 80, 90% of their kids in school. Jordan, pretty much full enrollment in school. The Gulf countries, they're very wealthy. They have all their kids in school. The issue then becomes not one so much of access, but one of quality. And I'm sure you've all read about the curriculum problems that exist in many Arab countries. The Saudi curriculum in particular is got a number of issues. We focus on the very, very worst and bad stuff in the Saudi curriculum because it makes headlines, the fact that they teach in the schools that men, how they should treat women is anathema to many people in this room. How they view Jews, how they view non-Sunni Muslims, how they view Christians, how they view just lots of views are things that would be absolutely intolerable for people in this room. And it has been a bilateral issue between the United States and the Saudis since 9/11. And I can say, having spent a fair amount of time on this issue, actually Prince Saud, the foreign minister, came to the Council on Foreign Relations last spring. He was here in Dallas too, I know. And he made a big point of saying, we fixed all the curriculum problems. Well, they haven't. There are still some issues in the curriculum, but they have made some improvements, certainly. And I have seen Saudi textbooks now that are trying to teach greater tolerance and diversity. And they're using women in pictures and displaying them in different roles that are non-traditional for Saudi curriculum. Getting that type of bad stuff out of the Saudi curriculum is difficult. But unfortunately, that's the easy part of changing the educational system. What you replace it with is even more difficult, because still Islamists within Saudi Arabia and across the region control curriculum, and there's an enormous emphasis on Islamist control over curriculum, which leads to very much focus on religious studies at the expense of math, science, engineering, English language study. And in every country, there are battles over these things. At what age can we introduce English, if at all? How much math, science, secular subjects can we teach? And so in every country, there's a tussle and a battle going on over this. So the Saudis are making efforts to take the bad stuff out, but they really haven't begun to deal with the fundamental changes that are required to move away from a teacher-focused, teacher-centric, rote memorization, very old-style pedagogy, which has disappeared in most of the modern world. And, if you walked in the classrooms that I was in Hockaday, and the way those kids are learning and the way they're learning critical thinking skills is absent in Saudi Arabia. And frankly, it's absent across most of the region. So one issue is the intolerance and the hatred that's being taught. But an even bigger issue is the fact that these kids are not learning skills that are enabling them to work in the modern economy. And today, you have very, very high rates of unemployment. 50% of the unemployed are between the ages of 15 and 24. And those are very difficult years to be unemployed. It's difficult at any age, but you have a disaffected youth. The highest levels of unemployment are among those with the most education. It's counterintuitive. But those with college degrees, they have expectations of the type of job that they want, which traditionally has been to go work in the government, in the public sector, to get a bureaucrat job. But the public sector is shrinking. It's under pressure from the IMF and from other sources. They're not hiring like they used to. And so young people now sit around waiting for jobs that just aren't there. And my research associate is Iranian, and she spent her summer in Iran. She came back and she said, it's just amazing to me. All of my cousins, they've all graduated from university. They're all unemployed, and they're all just sitting around waiting. Waiting for what? They just have no chance of employment at this point. I'm not even talking about Iran. I'm even talking about the Arab world. But this is a problem really across the whole region. So what are the solutions? Right now, the region is flush with money. And so it is a time, I think, where it's easier to make the investments and change when you have money as opposed to when you don't. And so I think there needs to be a focus and emphasis and a push to really help these governments address their real fundamental challenge of restructuring their educational systems to make them more to make their graduates more employable. And remember, young Arab graduates are competing in a world that is also accommodating the rise of India and China at the same time. And so this is a particularly tough time for people from the Middle East who, as middle-income countries, are really trying to find their place in the global economy. So Are there any bright spots? I have been traveling around the region looking at examples of efforts to change things at both ends of the spectrum, the primary level and also at the university level. Egypt has had some really interesting initiatives over the past decade. It's been going on for a decade now. Funded by UNICEF, also funded by USAID, they're called community schools, and it really has profoundly altered the way that primary school children are taught in Egypt. You've gone from a teacher standing up at a blackboard, when they show up, writing things on a board that children just write down and memorize, to a classroom that any of us would recognize as our own children in kindergarten or first or second grade. Very much interactive, team-based, playing games, really teaching those critical thinking skills. Parent-teacher councils have been formed. Parents are therefore involved in making decisions about curriculum, about teachers. Parents are participatory in all sorts of ways. The community votes on a number of different issues, which is very much grassroots democracy. I mean, in so many ways, they're doing everything right. Question then is, how do you scale it? And right now, these community schools have been around for about a decade. Maybe a couple hundred thousand children are in these community schools, but there are millions and millions of young people in the Egyptian school system, and you really have to change the whole state system to look more like this, and I think this should be a priority of USAID working with the Egyptian government. But I will tell you, from having traveled throughout the region, it's just not what is on our diplomats' agendas right now. At the secondary level, there are again examples of quality education being attempted. You know, King Abdullah in Jordan has started a Deerfield Academy. He attended Deerfield, and he has brought that concept of a really top-rate secondary school to Jordan. Again, it's very on the margins. It's elitist. It's a private academy that will be for Jordanian elites. But the idea, and I know from conversations with Jordanians, is to take that as a model and to begin to expand it and scale it throughout the country. But there are examples of models like this that are being attempted in the region, that are being well-received, that are gaining traction. And again, it should be a focus of our government and also our private sector to find ways to encourage that. At the university level, there are a couple, again, examples. There's Al Qaim University in Morocco, which I was there in November. It's doing everything right, but it's small. It's a small private university, but it is got an international faculty. It's got a completely modern curriculum and pedagogy. It's got international students. It's even started an incubator to teach entrepreneurial skills to its students and try to spin out businesses. Qatar has Education City, and they've made joint ventures with lots of different American universities, including Texas A&M, Cornell School of Medicine, all sorts of different universities. If American universities, and one of the few bright spots that's left today for the American brand, is our university system. It is greatly admired. It is much coveted. People want to go to American universities still. If you are a young man or woman growing up in the Middle East, and you can have your dream, it would be to go to UC Berkeley or MIT or really any of the American universities. It's truly a dream still. And we need to encourage the American brand in ways that it is still revered, which is in our educational system, to work with institutions in the Middle East, partner with them, and help develop both curriculum, teacher training programs, student exchanges, all sorts of things. Vocational training. There are a number of organizations that are really trying to do targeted vocational training in the Middle East. Unfortunately, vocational training is a dirty word in the Middle East. It's got a bad reputation, much as it does in this country, too. But vocational training is very, very important, and there are certain segments which, if you can get private sector involvement to really make the vocational training directly market relevant, then I think it can be very effective. There's a group called Education for Employment, and they are partnering with different institutions in the region to develop nursing programs. And they are, we have a nursing shortage around the world, in the Middle East, in Europe, in the United States. So if we can help young men and women in the Middle East train to be nurses, there are direct employment opportunities from that. Salesforce, call centers. There are call centers being in Tunisia. There are some call centers in Morocco. The Maghreb countries are French-speaking. There's a direct market relevancy there to Europe. So there are opportunities, and there are organizations that are working both nonprofit and public-private partnerships to try to target specific segments that that can find employment. Intel has a program, Teach Essentials Online. It's a program, it's an online training program that is geared for teaching computer skills really online, and then Intel then employs a lot of the graduates of a program. Save the Children has some very interesting programs, Jordan, Palestine, Egypt, targeted vocational training where they take recent graduates from both secondary and at the college level and match them with employers and really try to help them develop more more marketable skills. So there are glimmers around the region, people trying to do this, but it just needs to be expanded, it needs to be scaled, it needs to be supported much more aggressively than we're doing. Privatization. You know, the Saudis right now have on the books the plans to open 4,000 private schools. It's a huge number. The Saudis have a lot of money, and those who are interested in these educational issues, I think, have decided that they cannot reform the system from within. There's just too much opposition from conservatives, both religious and other conservatives in the country. So they're going to go outside of the existing state-run system and open private schools. And they have been given a green light to have pretty much freedom in the curriculum to do so. And I can tell you there are a number of venture capitalists that I've bumped into in the Saudi airport who are over there looking at this as an investment opportunity because there is, I think, significant money to be made. The Saudis have money and they're willing to pay, but it's an indication of the hunger that exists for more modern and relevant education. And that's a fine solution for Saudi Arabia, but in other parts of the region which are not so wealthy, it's not realistic. So what can the United States do? I think that going back to where I started, re-energizing the conversation around economic reform and all that that entails, including educational reform, is very, very important. And it's hard to do given where we are right now in our relationship with the Middle East. It's hard to do with the overwhelming focus that has been on trying to have a military solution to problems that are beyond a military solution. And it's also difficult given how tarnished the reputation of America is right now. But there is a hunger for it, there is a need for it, and I think it's a potential starting place to try to build some bridges. Public-private partnerships, bringing universities, bringing private sector, bringing governments together, I think is the only way to move forward and to find some viable solutions. And this problem that I'm talking about, this very young demographic, really should be an opportunity. The rest of the world is aging rapidly. Even China is aging rapidly. The Middle East is the youngest workforce in the world, and it's on Europe's doorstep. So if we can help figure out a way to channel that youth and provide the education and the training and help some of the cultural changes that need to happen, this young demographic should actually be a gift, a demographic gift to the region. The Middle East, over the next 40 years, will have the lowest dependency ratio of any region in the world, meaning working-age population is very large. The number of old people and the number of very young that the working age population has to support is low relative to the working age population. And that's the sweet spot for economic development. You can plow, you can be very productive, you can have a large tax base, and you don't have to make huge investments in old people's health care and young people's education. And so they have a moment, a generational moment, to take advantage of that. And it's, I think, our obligation to help them to do so. Thank you. High illiteracy.
Right.
I guess it's a colonial legacy. They had a very different post-colonial history. So in 1956, when they got their independence from France, Bourguiba just top-down, you know, I'm going to drag my country out of Turk-like into the modern world. And one of his big initiatives was women's empowerment and putting boys and girls in school. Tunisia in 1956 passed the most progressive family law in the region, and it was one of the most progressive laws in the world for women. Abortion was made legal, contraception was widely distributed, sex education in school, girls in school. Women were really very much a part of the development agenda. Women were in parliament, women judges, and in Morocco it was totally different. They had really no changes. It was almost it looked like it had prior to the French arriving. And Morocco suffered from the additional problem of the educational system being a lycée system, and all elites were taught in French, and that didn't change. And so you had elites in Morocco being educated in French, speaking in French, and also elites being educated in classical Arabic, something that nobody speaks. And so the vast majority of the country was completely cut off from the educational system.
For those of you who know, I used to live in Tunisia, so whenever there's a plug for Tunisia, I'd be very happy.
Two questions down the line. You mentioned at the outset of your talk that there were two philosophies or objectives. One was the economic, one was the military. Obviously, we've opted for military, and in my opinion, and I agree with you, it appears as though that is effective. My question is, and I agree with you in terms of economic, in fact, I'm a believer in soft diplomacy, with the Voice of America, and I don't think we've budgeted properly in taking advantage of soft diplomacy. In any event, can we initiate economic philosophy simultaneously with the military situation, or do we need to extricate ourselves from the military, shall we say, in order to initiate the economic?
And let me just clarify, when I said that the debate, it wasn't actually between economic and military, it was between economic and political. Do we focus on forcing democratization, or do we focus on economic reform? And most people, when they talked about forcing democratization, were not talking about a military way to do that, but going to Egypt and demanding greater human rights, greater openness, greater transparency, greater political freedom, and actual freedom to vote. And many people said, that's going to bring to power the Muslim Brotherhood. And those people promoting democracy said, so be it, they'll get into power and realize that they actually have to move right to the middle to manage things. Others said, no, that's not a good model. The Muslim Brotherhood would come into power, as they did almost in Algeria, and or the Islamists in Algeria, and one man, one vote, one time. Instead, we need economic reform, get these countries to a point where they will opt for a more moderate political system. Then the military option got layered in on top of that, and not only are we going to have democracy, but we're going to force democracy. And I think the failure of that in Iraq has set back all talk of reform enormously. And to answer your question, we are much more hard-pressed to talk about any type of reform, economic reform included, today than we were before we started our disastrous military interventions. If we should find ourselves bombing Iran directly or through proxy, these conversations, I wouldn't even dare stand up in front of you and have them. However, these countries themselves, most of them are not adjacent to Iraq. They had these problems before we invaded Iraq, and they will have them for many years after. And they have their own sense of urgency, and they do want help, and they are looking for solutions, and they're looking for assistance. So I think there's still an opportunity there to be constructive. If we got out of Iraq, it probably it certainly would free up resources in this country to think differently about the region.
I'm a conference interpreter working with Portuguese for Brazil, and on your educational, what you said about education, I interpreted recently for our organization called BEST and Associates right here in Dallas with wonderful programs of buying educational successful private institutions in many countries in the world for this education, vocational, for market relevance. On the other hand, I interpreted in Orlando recently with a huge annual assembly of an organization called National Education Association, NEA, and I thought and I saw very vividly how everybody there was believed only in public education. Now, one of the things I admire the most about this country is entrepreneurship, the spirit of entrepreneurship, and everything. And I asked around, and they seemed like one lady literally said, "We don't want private school teachers to even belong in our organization." So, could you comment anything on that? Why some of the past presidents of NEA were there for a lunch, and they said, "An interpreter together with an interpreter," and they said, "No, this country is built on our public education system," which is great, but
here and the. These were all Americans. Were they all Americans?
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, I mean, they're, you know, the United States has the benefit of a we all like to criticize our public school system in this country and talk about how bad it is. And certainly there are examples of failing public school systems around America. But I have to tell you, American public school is still so much better than so many public school systems in other parts of the world. And American school children consistently do worse than others on math and science tests, undoubtedly. And 17% of Americans in a recent poll couldn't identify the United States on a map. I mean, we do have clearly some issues, but I will tell you that American students have something that, frankly, Chinese students and Japanese students and Arab students wish they had more of, which is from a very early age, they're taught to critical thinking skills. They're taught to question. They're taught to examine. And it's something that is cultural. And, you know, in Japan, in the 1990s, the country went through a tremendous time of self-reflection after the bubble burst. Why can't we produce entrepreneurs? Why can't we produce a Bill Gates? Why can't we be at the cutting edge? We do some things very well in Japan. You know, we do precision manufacturing very well. But to be on that cusp of developing new technologies, gosh, all the dropouts in America, they seem to do it. And there was some truth to that. You know, American dropouts, some of them do pretty well. And I'm not directly answering your question, but there is reason to be proud of American public education. When I was in, one more quick comment, when I was in Morocco recently for a conference, there was a person there from Miami-Dade Community College who was there to talk about their vocational training programs. And the reaction of the ministers of education from the Arab countries around the region was, not for us. It's beneath us. You know, vocational training, it's a dead end. And a woman said to me, who was an education official from Egypt, she says, we have a saying in Arabic, and it's vocational training, you're going to end up in the garage. And I said to her, you know, the garage has a vaunted position in American lore. You know, the garage is where you want to end up and become Bill Gates or, you know, David Packard. And it's a very different attitude.
We have a question.
What I don't hear in this discussion is that if education is the answer, does that mean that the jobs are there and the people who are just not educated to take them? I mean, don't these two things need to be very much weighed with each other?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are, you know, it's a chicken and egg, but there are jobs there. In when I say there are companies all over Europe now, which is just across the Mediterranean from that part of the world, that are desperately seeking employees. They have.
Does that mean to immigrate to Europe?
Not necessarily. That not necessarily. I mean, Europe has trouble with immigration, as we all know. We have trouble with it, but they have more trouble with it. And but they are outsourcing, but they're not thinking of outsourcing, maybe to Tunisia. But other than that, they're not thinking of outsourcing to Morocco. They're not thinking of outsourcing to Egypt. You know, they'd much rather outsource to India for a whole variety of reasons. And that gets back to the educational problems in the region. So I mean, it's not just European jobs. I mean, I did start out by saying that that part of the world needs economic liberalization to make it easier for them to create their own businesses and their own more vibrant private sector. Certainly.
You mentioned there were several examples of your field academy and a couple of other universities that were sort of on the cutting edge and good examples. I'm wondering if those are providing equal opportunities for girls and women as far as not just coursework but also athletics and mentoring. And then, and I'm sorry to ask a two-part question, but we hear a lot from Bush administration about the success in getting girls into schools in Afghanistan, maybe Pakistan, and that this is an example of what we've done well so far in the past few years. What, do you have any numbers on that? How successful really is that? And what kind of difference is it making? How long is it going to take for that to sort of move up the food chain?
Okay. The very quick answer to your first question, yes, best practice in all of these places is gender equality. Absolutely. I wouldn't say that they're so hot in Title IX type athletics, but athletics isn't a big part of the Arab curriculum, period. Girls' education in Afghanistan, there are more girls in school today in Afghanistan than ever before in its history, yet there are more girls out of school than in school. Only about 30% of girls are actually in school in Afghanistan. 70% are not in school. So although it's a record for Afghanistan, it will take about 80 years at current rates until all girls are enrolled in school. So we got a long way to go. I think the United States has been helpful in providing educational opportunities for girls in Afghanistan. But there is so much demand and certainly not enough supply.
But if I ask a follow-up on Afghanistan, do you feel that the situation is truly improving there or in the last 18 months would you say it's declining?
Well, I mean, I think we have to kind of disaggregate it. You know, the economy improved at about a 15% clip last year. There's a lot of, and that's the real economy, not the opium economy, which probably improved at a 200% clip. You know, there are more girls in school, there are more boys in school. Parts of the country are relatively peaceful and, for Afghanistan, relatively prosperous. I mean, it's a terribly poor country, but then there are parts of the country where there is resurgent Taliban activity, and there's been a lot of, I mean, Kabul has seen suicide bombs. And the south, all around Kandahar, you see people living in fear today. And there are whole regions of the country where there are no girls in school. Zero. you know, not one. And that is a very effective Taliban policy of fear, targeting for assassination teachers, parents, and girls themselves who are going to school. And parents, therefore, will, you know, say, okay, you win. We're not going to send our girls to school. And people are afraid. People are frightened. And so in parts of the country, it's certainly gone backwards.
Yes, sir.
The correlation between educational opportunities in, say, Asian Islamic countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, versus Arab Islamic countries, did you correlate that? Is there anything to be gained from looking at the opportunities of Asia versus Middle East? And in terms of Sharia law, or...
Well, I mean, the Asian countries have had a more moderate and, in some cases, progressive form of Islam for centuries. And there has been a much greater emphasis on education, certainly in the post-war years. You know, when just thinking about girls in school, in 1945... the Middle East, Arab region, and the Asian countries had roughly the same gender gap of boys versus girls in school. And the Middle East countries kind of chugged along as is, and the Asian countries dramatically and quickly closed that gap. They got their girls in school, and they got all children in school, and just had a much more, much higher emphasis on education. And, you know, the results show today. I mean, they have... also different governments, different, so many different components that it's hard to just pin it on education. But today you have groups in Malaysia, in Indonesia, pushing for stricter versions of Sharia, or pushing for Sharia where it hasn't been before. And, you know, it remains to be seen how that plays out. So far it's pretty much been kept at bay.
In the back, please.
Now, in countries like India and China, there's been such will from within towards having economic development and being a part of the world markets. And you said chicken and egg. I'm going to use that phrase. I don't know to what extent the chicken and egg had an issue with changes in education that fueled the desire to change the thinking about the economy or the other way around. I'm sure it's not going to be answered. But my question is, in the Arabic world, is there anyone from within who is really pushing for Western-style market economies, or is the culture so resistant to being a part of that that that's really getting in the way of that happening? And perhaps it comes back to the issue of education. But I'm just curious as to whether or not that anyone there, beyond the oil market, is really interested in Western-style markets.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that the Chinese are necessarily interested in truly Western-style economic markets. They have their own version of capitalism and development, as have the Indians over... I mean, I think India is trending more towards a Western style, but they have their own version of it. And in the Middle East, I think what you see, maybe not people... demanding unfettered capitalism because they're afraid of it. You know, they're afraid of losing. Certainly, elites in those countries are afraid of losing their privileges. However, I think what you do see is a growing realization that they need to find employment opportunities, and that it's not going to be from global, not solely from global multinational companies coming in and employing people. That's never going to do it. It's not going to be from state-led companies. It's not going to be from government jobs. They have to unleash the private sector. They have to, you know, I've been asked to give talks all over the Middle East about small business development. So there's a hunger for it. People are interested in knowing how is it the largest, you know, driver of employment in this country is small business. And they don't have that in that part of the world, and they're searching for how to let it organically grow. So there's some who understand that it needs to be part of the solution.
We have time for one more question, two more questions. Susan and then Larry. Larry, tell me your question. Larry, what do you do?
Okay, I was going to ask you this corruption and play a major part in economic development, job opportunity, and that part. And can the government do something to help in that area? And Susan, what's your question?
The motivation and work ethic of the students.
Okay, both good questions. Corruption is certainly a barrier. You know, if you're a company, do you want to invest in a country where you know that there's a lot of corruption? But talk to anybody doing business in China. Huge corruption in China and in India. And so a lot of markets are corrupt, and yet they still attract enormous direct investment. So there are ways around it, or it's a cost of doing business if the opportunity is attractive enough. Unfortunately, what we've had is high corruption and not attractive opportunities. And so it's not a winning combination. So yes, greater transparency, working on corruption is important. The work ethic. You know, at this conference I was in Morocco recently, there were a number of representatives from the private sector there. And they said that their biggest issue with employing college graduates from Moroccan universities, all of the things on their list were work ethic issues. All of them. Showing up to work on time, appropriate dress, tolerance and diversity for other people in the workplace. Stuff that is very basic and very one-on-one. And those are the types of things that are really hard to address when they're 22 years old and have to start at a much earlier age.
This cultural issue where the other things in their life really are more important than in their culture.
Thank you.
And for a concluding question.
I think you can stay to visit informally for a few more minutes, I believe, but not for long.
Yep,
you know, you want to. You know, one thing I want to mention is that Isabel has a family in New York and really makes a commitment and sacrifices to do the important research that she does. Isabel, when was your article in Foreign Affairs? It was last year. Which issue?
Which one?
That on women. That was in the
two and a half.
All right. When was your last one?
January.
In any event, as you can see, she has several articles published in Foreign Affairs. I encourage you to go to cfr.org to see those. And again, Isabel, you're always welcome here at the World Affairs Council. We hope you'll continue to keep us updated on your research.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.